As a real estate manager, Principal Asset Management harnesses the power of a 360-degree perspective, delivering local insights and global expertise across public and private equity and debt. Their teams apply local insights and global perspectives to help identify the most compelling investing opportunities. Principal Asset Management, actively invested. Learn more at principalam.com. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Principal Asset Management SM is a trade name of Principal Global Investors LLC.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Odd Lots podcast. I'm Joe Weisenthal.
And I'm Tracy Alloway.
Tracy, so obviously markets continuing to have an extraordinary year, at least risk assets for the most part. Stocks continue to power to new all-time highs all around the world, optimism breaking out. But I'd say like the nature of the stock market rally or the nature of the market rally in general is sort of taken on a different complexion lately.
I think people have been nervous about valuations for some time, and the idea that even though we've had the biggest pandemic in over 100 years, which has really eaten into economic activity, we still have stocks at a record. People sort of naturally feel a little bit nervous about that. And then recently, we had the sell-off in U.S. Treasuries as well, and a little bit of a pickup in inflation expectations, which might be the beginning of, some people are talking about it being the beginning of a bigger change for the market.
And this would be a good time, actually, to mention that we are recording this on Thursday, December 3rd, 9 a.m.
The usual 2020 caveat.
Yeah, that the whole world may have changed by the time anyone actually listens to this episode. But yeah, we have seen a little bit of an uptick in treasury yields, market-based measures of inflation, actually higher than they were pre-crisis, but some measures back to levels not seen since 2019. And also, if you look at some of the really hot stocks lately, it's some of the real, like, sort of back-to-normal, unsexy stuff out there. So it's like airlines and physical retail. I think like shares of Macy's were up like 75% in November. U.S. Steel, steel company, absolute wild chart if you take a look at that. So whereas in the beginning of this rally, and it, thinking back to the spring, it was very much like tech and the stay-at-home trade. We're starting to see it broaden out. And so people like buying energy, another area, oil doing very well. So these areas that did not participate in the first part of the recovery or for several months into this have been getting a lot of excitement lately or enthusiasm.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, we have talk about, you know, another sort of great rotation coming up.
Hey, yeah, right. And of course, every time we talk about these rotations, there's the question is like, is this another head fake? Is everyone just going to go back to buying FANG and Microsoft and, of course, Treasuries in a couple weeks? Or is this something new? So lots to think about as we close out 2020 from a macro perspective, all kinds of different moving parts going into 2021.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's clearly a lot going on, but 2021 is going to be an interesting year, right? Like if you just look at the market currently at all-time highs, you have that broadening of the rally. The big question is whether or not it's going to keep going. And then you have all these idiosyncratic events like what happens with the vaccine. And of course, how do central banks respond to that? If we get a vaccine and the economy really starts to recover, then could you finally get inflation, which, you know, could unsettle the market in one way or another? So I think you're right. Like there are these turning points that you can sort of see on the horizon. But the big question is whether or not, we're just going to be talking about them or actually experiencing them, whether or not it's another head fake. Yes.
Yeah. No, it's going to be a really interesting year. Hopefully it's not as interesting as 2021.
Yeah.
But, you know, for our sakes, from a stuff to talk about standpoint, we hope it's at least somewhat interesting. Anyway, macro. So, yeah, to talk about the outlook, I thought we'd bring on two of the smartest people we know who discuss macro from both a pure econ perspective and a markets perspective. Both have previously been on the show. I want to bring on Naufal Sinhala. He's a macro strategist and portfolio manager at EIA All Weather Alpha Partners, and John Turek. He's the author of the Cheap Convexity blog, which has been a must read all year for people in the know on macro and market, sort of tying together both the price action and the bigger economic themes of the year. So Naufal and John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming back. So I'll sort of start off broad, and either one of you could pick up, but sort of like, what's the number one thing on your mind right now in terms of this sort of the big questions or the big things to get right when you're thinking about the outlook for markets in 2021?
I think we would probably both agree that the dollar is, you know, kind of at the focal point of our analyses. You know, we are in a very new, interesting regime with the Fed. And if the Fed is to follow through on this, you know, new regime and framework, then what that would suggest is that, you know, as we get positive outcomes in the macroeconomy, it should actually lead to feedback loops via a lower dollar. And so that's why we've been, you know, here at EIA, we've been really focused on expressing a lot of our bullish trades through short dollar expressions. So I think getting the dollar right, getting the Fed right, and then figuring out the similarities and differences between what is a vaccine type of reflation and what is a, you know, typical stimulus type of reflation. And John's written about all of these things in a lot of detail, and had some great framework. So I'll let him jump in a little bit too.
Yeah, no, I think as has been the case, you know, in the last few weeks, I think the dollar will probably continue to be like the fulcrum instrument for kind of how the market digests and prices going forward this recovery. I think what's kind of interesting is, and as Naufal was suggesting with the new Fed reaction function, is that the Fed has moved from like their primary objective of being able to cut off left tails, right? To suggest that, okay, something's bad has happened. How do we respond either through, you know, financial markets or whatever? And now as there's a train in motion, the Fed's best move in terms of kind of accommodating this recovery will basically be pushing whatever the train is and giving it another nudge. So in end of Q3, we thought this train was probably going to be fiscal. And in August, we were kind of pricing this more MMT type world. And then fiscal negotiations kind of fell apart. We had an election where we're likely going to have a divided government. So the market scope for fiscal kind of came down. And now, post the vaccine news, we kind of begin to entertain a market that is like goes from a fiscal-led recovery to a private sector-led recovery. And that may change the channel, but it still gets the train in motion. And now the Fed can jump on and say, okay, like there was, you know, an awful pandemic last year, and now we're in 2021 with a vaccine, and that doesn't really change anything for policy. And that's a really powerful, I think, macro tool for them to basically push forward this recovery.
Naufal, you mentioned the idea of a weaker dollar and feedback loops. Could you maybe go into some more detail about how exactly you see that working?
Yeah. So with respect to the dollar more structurally, you know, if you think about the regime from, say, the financial crisis until COVID, you know, the dollar was like the only game in town in terms of collecting yield and having positive growth prospects in the major economies and the major accessible markets. COVID's really changed that dynamic as, you know, the Fed's kind of caught down to like Europe and Japan interest rates wise, as well as has changed its reaction function to be far more dovish and far more accommodative to positive outcomes. At the same time, China has kind of taken the role of, you know, the yield premium, and they've made some changes to their markets, you know, since especially since 2015 when they had their FX policy shift. And you know, the Chinese government bond market has really turned into this, I think the way John put it once is just, you know, it's like one big sucking sound of capital, just really big one-way flows. And so what that kind of means to me is that, there's a structural headwinds to the US dollar, and those will not only be reflecting positive outcomes and reflationary outcomes, but will also likely be driving them in a feedback loop as well, through a variety of channels, both through, you know, what that means to current accounts, as well as, you know, just general credit creation.
I'm curious about this idea, and John, you've talked about it a lot, both of you, but the idea of there being a meaningful difference between a fiscal stimulus-led reflation and a vaccine-led reflation. So it's funny because, you know, as you discussed, John, it's like, going into Q3, beginning of Q4, the thought was like, okay, maybe we're going to get a fiscal deal, or maybe Biden is going to win and get a Democratic Senate, and then they're going to pass a massive bill next year. But then that didn't happen. We didn't get the unified government. There's no fiscal deal as of yet. And yet, like a couple of days after the election, we got the really good news about from Pfizer about their vaccine, and suddenly people realized that a vaccine is likely coming and it's going to be effective, and the renormalization of economic activity might truly begin in earnest sometime in the beginning of 2021. So from a sort of market standpoint, what are the meaningful distinctions between that recovery led by a vaccine and a return to normal versus a recovery led by a sort of CARES Act 2.0?
Right. I think it's such a key point, honestly, and it has been a big theme for the last few weeks. And I think it works through two channels. I think one is the fundamental economic channel, which is to say that a fiscal deal that has a very heavy composition towards transfer payments has a much more immediate nominal impact, right? Because it goes into people's pockets, people can spend, there's a consumption element, and it's much more nominal because it's not followed by, there's no new productivity, there's no new investment, et cetera. It's very consumption focused. And that trickles out through the trade deficit. It's a weaker dollar, but it's consumption led. So it has a much more nominal impact. The vaccine, on the other hand, is different in the sense that it's much more on the corporate side, in the sense that it gives businesses kind of more clarity in terms of CapEx, inventory restocking, more, you know, business related decisions. And that has more of a real impact in terms of, you know, leading to potentially like higher levels of real growth in the coming year. And I think basically what the market kind of did with this transition from a fiscal regime to a vax regime is it traded scope for certainty, right? The potential of like more of an MMT type fiscal approach was kind of like, oh, we could have like high levels of nominal GDP and that could be pretty cool. But what the vaccine regime brings is like, we kind of know what the world's going to look like end of Q2 on next year. And that has a massive reduction in risk premium, and the market can levitate off that.
And if I could add a little bit to that as well, you know, you definitely have seen this, what John's mentioning, you've definitely seen it in the markets, whether it's, you know, some of the beaten down cyclicals, whether it's, you know, the trade sensitive places like, you know, the Nikkei has been one of our longs to play this vaccine trade. And even, you know, these dislocations between gold prices and real yields, I think all three of those things reflect exactly what John's saying with respect to the reduction of risk premium. But in addition as well, I think one other distinction between the two types of, two types of reflation are that the consumption basket mix should likely shift towards services as, we get this normalization type of dynamic. And that should be really interesting to me because for two reasons. One tailwind to the short dollar and long renminbi type of dynamic has been how much, the consumption basket mix has flattered, you know, the goods exporters like China. We may see some hiccups, or some retracements or this or that. Sometime, you know, early next year, but especially if, you know, the trend's able to persist and ultimately get through those, you know, those types of transitions, that would really reinforce the case that this is a structural shift and has, you know, a lot of legs to go. And the second point with respect to this, you know, the consumption basket mix shift to services is one thing I'm really interested on and to see is if there's been, if COVID ends up being a permanent downward shock to the labor intensity of services output, as in, you know, services output and services demand rebounds, but does the employment side of it underperform the output side of it? And that would be, that'd be really interesting. You know, the idea being, you know, what the WTO and the Chinese entrance of the WTO, what it was to goods and the labor intensity of goods, we could see a smaller version of that materialize in services. I don't have a strong view yet about this. I think it's really going to be just something to keep in the back of our minds and see how it unfolds in real time. But if that were to materialize, that would just give that much more of a tailwind to, for the Fed to remain accommodative, because you know the employment would not be, the employment picture wouldn't be recovering you know necessarily as swiftly as expected on the services side.
So just on that note, I mean, we are starting to see some commentators, including some former Odd Lots guests, but you know, people like Tim Dewey at the University of Oregon, talking about the potential to have a supercharged economy next year, where you know, everything looks pretty good. You get a vaccination, people go back to spending, unemployment rebounds and isn't actually, you know, as bad as maybe the Fed was expecting, and perhaps it sparks a little bit of inflation that puts the Fed in an awkward position. Is that a risk that you see for next year, or do you think the structural changes that you just described are going to be enough to avoid that scenario?
Me personally, I think the Fed will likely remain accommodative. What should be interesting is, you know, to the extent that we see these dynamics start to emerge in the conversations, it's likely to be reflected in internal divisions within the FOMC. And so what I'll be really interested to see is how Chair Powell kind of navigates those decisions, those divisions, and, you know, kind of put on a bit of, like, look at some of his statements through more of a political lens along those lines. But yeah, I think that there's a pretty high chance that we have a very strong economy next year. You know, some of these sell side forecasts may actually be, you know, a little bit lower than, you know, what I would expect. And, you know, we'll know more, you know, later this month, but especially around the March FOMC meeting. But the signs so far suggest to me that, you know, this is a new regime shift and we're not really going to, they're not really going to get ahead of it. And just to be clear, with respect to what I was mentioning with the labor intensity of output of services, that would be more of a question about on the back end, like not necessarily in the next few months, but more so about, you know, what's the long term run rate of, you know, employment growth in the services side? And what does that mean for, you know, Fed forecasts? Where are they likely to have to mark up and down, you know, the longer term forecast? But I know this is another question that I'm sure John has some great thoughts about, too. So I'll let him jump in.
Yeah, no, I think it's really interesting in the sense that the recovery next year is going to look very different than ones of at least the most recent past in terms of output shocks, in the sense that balance sheets are in a much better position, as people like, you know, Tim Dewey have said, that there's, you know, there's this element of excess savings. And that's kind of come from this combination of the CARES Act kind of having this huge multiplier, but also having the, you know, with the virus, having these constraints in terms of people's ability to spend it. And I think the other thing is we actually went into the crisis with, you know, household balance sheets in relatively good shape. So coming out of it, it's not that usually in a recession, you kind of have this lethargic hysteresis kind of as people have to repair balance sheets. And that's why it takes time for recoveries to get off the ground. And I think that could be very different this time, given that it's just we had a recession where disposable income went up. So it could, you know, very much change the scope of the recovery. And as it relates to the Fed, I think this is something I'm fairly confident, I think, and people are underestimating, is I don't think the Fed reaction function or response so far is cyclical. I think it's structural. And what I mean by that is I think the Fed is kind of is not saying like this was the right reaction to a COVID shock in the sense of their forward guidance, balance sheet policy, and their and et cetera. I think what they're saying is like we got things wrong a few years ago, and that's not going to happen again. And the manifestation of that will be that, yes, things are going to be quote unquote back to normal in the middle of next year, but the Fed won't, because it's not a cyclical response, it's a structural response. So I think the Fed will be much more dovish than I think a lot of people think.
The recalibration of their approach, especially with respect to the Phillips curve, predates COVID, right? So what John's saying makes a lot of sense to me, and conversations with John have actually kind of influenced my view here. One last point I'd like to add there is, you know, I think that one of the biggest things that, you know, I had to adapt to in real time and kind of change my mind on is exactly that Tim Dewey hypothesis of excess savings. And, you know, John and I have talked a little bit about, you know, what would be cool ways to maybe think about the distributional aspects of this and if the data, you know, exists for that. And that could be a key question to really gauge how far it can take us through next year. But it is really interesting, you know, the initial conditions really do matter in terms of macroeconomic thinking. And the initial conditions, the balance sheet wise on the household side especially, don't really suggest that we have to have very elevated savings rates for a long time as balance sheets have to get repaired. And to the extent that we would need elevated savings rates in response to the, you know, virus uncertainty, it's kind of similar to what John was saying with respect to the risk premium compression on the back of the vaccine news. You trade scope for certainty, and that certainty ends up being a pretty big headwind to, you know, how high personal savings rates, you know, end up being next year.
As a leading real estate manager, Principal Asset Management harnesses the power of a 360-degree perspective, delivering local insights and global expertise across public and private equity and debt. Our experienced teams are uniquely positioned to uncover compelling opportunities in today's market, giving our clients an exclusive advantage. Principal Asset Management, actively invested. Learn more at principalam.com. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Principal Asset Management SM is a trade name of Principal Global Investors LLC.
So one of the questions, and I think, Nawfal, I've asked you this before, but it's something I've been curious about a lot. Like, all right, we talk about regime shift, and the Fed's regime shift is fairly clear, and you believe it, and they're going to be much less aggressive, they claim, in hiking rates. They're not going to be trying to get ahead of inflation in the same way. And so that's potentially quite significant. Obviously, the post-COVID economy could look different than the pre-COVID economy in ways, and maybe we'll talk about that more. But what does that mean for then sort of like normalized markets? And obviously, right now, as we said in the intro, we're in this era, or this, not an era, we're in this like moment where people are buying like Macy's and airlines and steel companies, companies that were not sexy at all pre-crisis, suddenly getting some sort of back to normal appeal. But in as we normalize, and maybe in sort of like Q3 of next year, things start to look genuinely normal. Do people just go back to buying Microsoft and Netflix and Tesla as their leaders, or does something fundamentally change where like new winners can emerge on a more sustainable basis?
That's a great question. I wish I had a great answer to that. You know, one thing that should be interesting along these lines is the results of the Georgia elections. It'll likely give some signal with respect to what we can expect on the fiscal front until the next batch of midterms in 2022. And that should be kind of interesting to keep in the back of our minds. But yeah, you know, I think that at some point next year, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, we kind of pivot back to, you know, people are long the long end of the bond market and long, you know, NASDAQ and China tech. And it's interesting actually seeing how we've already kind of we've despite the fact that we've had this huge cyclicals rally, you know, the NASDAQ actually did kind of catch up a little bit in recent sessions. So I think there's still going to likely be a structural demand for that type of stuff. And, you know, I would say, though, that like I'm actually more interested in, like, in terms of normalization trades that have durability, I'm more interested in looking at things in the emerging markets and looking at stuff that's sensitive to global trade growth, like the Nikkei, as opposed to, you know, just buying, you know, U.S. energy stocks and you know, retail operators.
I think he's 100% right. And I think one maybe of the more interesting transitions to come in, you know, 2021, 2022 could be in terms of like these narratives of like a fiscal reflation to a vax reflation, is that the vax reflation kind of morphs into this broadening of a risk premium compression. And I think like a lot of the market action post the vaccine kind of felt like the market was exhaling a little bit, right? Like it had all this built up risk premiums and like all these cyclicals had no idea. And you saw it like across asset classes in terms of like trade sensitive currencies, et cetera, EM bond markets, where there's just this very high level of risk premium. And I think this kind of really dates back a while. And why I think this could be maybe a bigger theme is that it could be another one of these regime shifts, because what we had in 2010 to 2020 was basically post financial crisis was basically exogenous shock after exogenous shock. And we went from the euro crisis to China deval concerns to Brexit to trade war and finally the mother of all shocks in terms of COVID. And unfortunately he passed away this year, but Emmanuel Farhi at Harvard actually did a lot of work on kind of why the market priced so much risk premium when discount rates were so low. And I think it has something to do with this. And it led to things like, you know, we'd have like the, you know, Swiss currency on a effective exchange rate valuation metric be at like, you know, just going a straight line from 2010 to 2020, when things that were like cyclically driven, like the Swedish krona or the Aussie dollar, things like that would kind of just be in a decline lower. And it was basically the market just saying, I want safety at all costs. And I don't want anything to do with cyclicals. I don't need that. There's this embedded risk premium. And I think it's right for it to be there. And I wonder if kind of the vaccine and the combination of all these left tail measures we've taken with fiscal filling in for deflation, with the European deal and things like that. I wonder if the combination of left tail changes and this catalyst to reduce risk premium kind of, you know, can have a higher trajectory than people think.
You know, I'm looking right now on the Bloomberg terminal of the MXEF, the emerging market index, and on a long term scale. And it's so interesting because, you know, we haven't gone anywhere since 2007. You know, it's just been a bunch of zigs and zags along the way. So, you know, a lot of volatility along the way, but we're basically, you know, haven't made any upward progress. I think this is before carry, albeit. But, you know, if the framing that John and I are presenting, especially with respect to the dollar, if those end up being right, then I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, some of these emerging markets are really kind of coiled and could be a really interesting and more durable trade. And as we kind of hand off, like John said, from just a pure vaccine exhalation to a broader based, you know, reduction of risk premium. I would expect, you know, the emerging markets trade to probably have more durability along those lines than just, you know, the U.S. cyclicals and U.S. Small value.
So this was actually going to feed into my next question, but we started this whole conversation talking about how the dollar is going to be really important to 2021. And the more you talk about sort of your specific ideas, I can see why you're so focused on the dollar. So clearly, if you're long emerging markets, that matters quite a lot. Do you think, well, first of all, what would it take to get a higher dollar in this environment? And secondly, is the suggestion here that the Federal Reserve has sort of become comfortable with this idea that it's the world's central bank and that it's actively looking at financial conditions and actively caring about a stronger US dollar and what it does to the rest of the world economy.
With respect to what it would take for a higher dollar, I mean, one thing that would obviously do that is if the Fed ended up being less dovish or less, you know, authentic in its reaction function shift than we might be thinking in this conversation. And more tactically, in terms of like shorter term trading, I think that, like I mentioned earlier, you know, the combination of the consumption basket mix shifting toward services at the same time as potential for, you know, maybe a little bit of compression of the yield spread between U.S. and China, that could give some hiccups along the way. Although I think they would be opportunities to add or enter into these types of trades. And with respect to the Fed, I do think that, you know, they've become more comfortable with this notion of being the world central bank. You know, Brainard's been really influential along the lines of how the international conditions kind of, you know, are part of the analysis the FOMC has to make. But I think more generally, you know, and even before COVID, it was just this notion that why were we hiking in the first place? Like, why were we short circuiting these recoveries when, you know, our Phillips curve kind of based models never really showed like it never materialized. The inflation never came. And, you know, what are the cost benefit trade offs? And I think they have come to the conclusion that it's time to let it rip. But again, you know, I think John's a little bit more confident than I am about this, although, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if I kind of converged to his views. But, you know, the question there, I think, is going to be about how does Chair Powell navigate what are likely to be kind of emerging internal divisions, even if they're not super strong, you know, as these, you know, as members of the FOMC start thinking about the back end of this recovery, more so than just the here and now, that should probably become more in play as a debate. And, you know, it should be interesting to see how he navigates that. And I'll let John hop in about both questions as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the Fed part, I think the Fed really nailed, and there's a Brainard speech in July that kind of really crystallized this when she talked about kind of stabilization to accommodation. And I think that the Fed is very now comfortable in the idea that a lot of their policy effects kind of happen in the second derivative. And it's not like the traditional Michael Woodford, oh, we do QE, real interest rates fall, term premium compresses, and aggregate demand goes bonkers. It's not like that anymore. It's how do we, through financial markets, through financial conditions, kind of create these feedback loops that basically allows our policy posture to expand for us. And it's actually much more durable because they're feedback loops, they play off each other, right? So the Fed can say that, okay, things are going well, that changes nothing for us. That has an effect on the dollar, which has an effect on real yields, which has an effect on the dollar. So kind of setting these things in motion, I think will add power to the Fed's very pro-cyclical ability to ease. And in terms of the dollar, in the sense of what could possibly be potential positive catalysts, I mean, I think number one is, I think, probably positioning. As like we kind of get into January and it becomes a very consensus view, there's always these Q1 shakeouts, it seems, in terms of the popular trades. But I think what may be actually kind of maybe able to offset that is that a lot of people, I think, want to play these trades in a catch-up sense, right? So you see these things like, oh, copper gold ratio has gone vertical and Russell versus S&P, et cetera. And the 10-year bond yield has done pretty much, I mean, it's, you know, marginally higher, but it's not really done anything. And I think a lot of macro is still kind of looking at like, okay, how do I pay rates to play this catch-up, or how do I do? And I think that's really missing the point, because the reason these things go vertical is because they keep looking over the Russell S&P ratio keeps looking over its shoulder at the bond market and seeing nothing. So that's what allows it to go nuts. And same with a lot of the cyclical data. And so I think that a lot of these things, yes, there'll be probably hiccups in terms of, you know, in terms of the recovery, in terms of the vaccine rollout, et cetera. But in bigger picture terms, I think the trades that are working now are still the bigger trades going forward.
As a leading real estate manager, Principal Asset Management harnesses the power of a 360-degree perspective, delivering local insights and global expertise across public and private equity and debt. Our experienced teams are uniquely positioned to uncover compelling opportunities in today's market, giving our clients an exclusive advantage. Principal Asset Management actively invested. Learn more at principalam.com. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Principal Asset Management SM is a trade name of Principal Global Investors, LLC.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization. We live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
I want to actually like really have you spell out that last point because it sounds pretty important. As people look at the rebound in small caps, value, commodities, copper, which is a commodity, and they're like, all right, but when are yields going to catch up? But it's not like that. There's no inherent, with this new Fed regime, there's no inherent reason for yields to catch up. And if anything, it's this ongoing compression of the long end of the curve that further accelerates the gap between the two. Just sort of explain that, or if I'm summarizing your view correctly, and how much longer that dynamic could potentially run.
Yeah, no, I think you actually summed it up perfectly. I think that it can run further in the sense that there will be these times when people are like, oh, maybe we can like price in hikes in 2023. And you've seen this recently a little bit on the back of the Vax reflation narrative, where within the bond market, if you look at like a butterfly, you'll see that the belly is kind of cheapening at the same rate that the long end is. And that's kind of saying like, okay, like maybe there'll be, you know, because usually when the belly leads, like the belly led the bond market lower. So that's like 5s, 7s, 10s. And when that happens, you kind of say like, okay, this could be a policy change is coming. But I think bigger picture is that all this stuff is kind of there used to be these cutoff mechanisms to these moves, right? As in cyclicals would get off the mat, the dollar would start going lower. And then we'd say, oh, this means in two years that the Fed can remove accommodation. And now we're saying that in 2 years, the Fed's accommodation level is going to look eerily similar to what it is now. And I think that's a very powerful point going forward.
You know, before we wrap up, Naval, I'd love to go back to your point about, could the COVID-19 crisis be to services productivity as China's entry into the WTO in 2000 was to goods productivity and the sort of deflation or disinflation that we saw for the next couple of decades in goods? Walk through your thinking there. What do you see happening out in the real world, out in the economy, that you think could cause this, where we return to services, pre-crisis levels of services consumption, but not pre-crisis levels of services employment? And sort of, A, why do you think that's a possibility? And what do you see as some of the knock-on effects of that?
Well, first of all, this is very speculative of a view. It's something that I'm just kind of, you know, I just want to see how it materializes. It's more of a question than a view. But this was a huge shock, and it was very, very concentrated in the services sector. And so there's always this kind of, you know, necessity is the mother of invention type of dynamic. So that's one thing I think that, you know, services oriented businesses have been likely focused a lot on the technological side, in terms of how they kind of restart their businesses. And secondly, you know, the COVID, the COVID shock kind of just digitized everything and pulled forward a lot of this kind of technological, you know, implementation of a lot of things. And so, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if that's how it materialized. What it would look like in terms of like on the ground, the real economy. It's a good question. I don't know if I have a great answer, but in terms of knock-on effects, what it would mean is that we would have another kind of wave of, you know, positive output shocks that the Fed doesn't necessarily need to short circuit because it's not seeing the same impulse on employment and inflation. And, you know, that's likely, you know, if that were to materialize, that would likely be, you know, another inequality widening dynamic. And, you know, it would lead to kind of like a Goldilocks type of environment for the markets. So, you know, that's one thing I'm interested to see as we restart the services sectors. What are we seeing in terms of the output versus employment picture, especially like later in the year, once we're kind of, because, you know, on the front end of reopening and normalization, you know, we should see a very robust hiring response in response to, you know, a rebound in demand. But I'm interested to see if that kind of tapers off a little bit relative to output. And if that does happen, then that probably has some implications for longer term bond yields unless and until we do see some sort of more structural fiscal policy shift, because, you know, I think that's going to be necessary to offset some of these inequality widening forces. And that's kind of when, you know, you start looking at the 2022 midterms and stuff like that. To an extent, the Georgia elections too. But even with the Georgia elections, you know, even if both seats go Democrat, it's 50-50 with a Vice President Harris tiebreaker. The folks with the most leverage in that environment would be the centrist Democrats. You know, you would need Joe Manchin on board for a lot of stuff. It's very different than, you know, if you have like 53-54 seats in the Senate, and you know, the progressives would have a lot more leverage. So that's kind of a messy way of me trying to lay out how I'm thinking about this.
So I'm thinking back to the beginning of this year, 2020, and when I think about all the crazy things that happened, I mean, just in January, we had the beginning of the COVID outbreak in earnest in Wuhan. We had you know, the U.S. and Iran getting pretty close to an all-out war. Lots of things happening. I mean, Kobe Bryant dying in a helicopter crash, like, that was a big deal as well. I mean, I'm thinking about how to phrase this question, but like, what is your tail risk that you're watching out for in 2021? But not the obvious ones, like we don't get a vaccine that works. What's your sort of out there? What's your left field tail risk for 2021?
Yeah, the unknown unknown. I think that I won't try and predict that, but I'll go with, I think that it will be very interesting in a policy sense, not only like kind of gauging new reaction functions in fiscal and central banks around the world, but kind of gauging when will the rate of change matter in terms of policy easing, right? And it's like, will the end of 2021 be kind of these rolling cliffs of either central bank accommodation ending and fiscal accommodation ending? Because we like to forget that even though that, you know, the US has had a messy kind of fiscal picture, even though the CARES Act was obviously such a success, the rest of the world is actually kind of doing it a lot more effectively. I mean, Europe has its issues with disbursements of the, you know, the supranational project, but Germany and France both acted when mitigation measures went back into effect. Canada is, you know, promising more fiscal next year. Australia, New Zealand, the same. Even Korea, surplus Korea, has an expansionary budget for next year. Japan's on their third or fourth supplementary budget. So a lot of these, you know, these changes in what was previously pretty dogmatic behavior from a lot of fiscal actors has happened. And the question is, I guess, kind of looking at it for more of a tail risk scenario, is what if a lot of this goes off, kind of cliffs off at the same time? And then the market kind of becomes uncomfortable with this fiscal transition, you know, into the private sector, because for the last 10 years, the private sector hasn't exactly achieved escape velocity on its own, or doesn't have a good track record of it. So I think in terms of risks, I guess that would be my 2021 risk.
I think that makes a lot of sense too. You know, as John's mentioned a lot about how there's kind of a pro-cyclicality element and dynamic with respect to this Fed regime. So if we do see some rolling cliffs in terms of rate of change of policy accommodation, at the same time as kind of the big normalization boost kind of starts to taper off, that could be kind of a nasty cocktail, especially because, you know, and this is a question I'm really interested to see in the back half of next year, you know, what is the run rate that we kind of converge back to? Like, you know, has nothing really changed in the underlying picture? You know, once we're past, you know, the COVID shock and then the normalization shock, upward shock, you know, are we in the same kind of nominal growth environment as before? Because if so, you know, tapering off to that kind of run rate at the same time as you know, if we do see some sort of cliffs on the policy front, it'll be pro-cyclical on the way down as well, the same way it's been really effective on the way up. And I guess the other thing I would mention would be, you know, just the typical classic macro punter geopolitics, right? Anything can happen with respect to geopolitics. I think it'll be interesting to see the approach that President-elect Biden takes with respect to China. I understand the, you know, it's nice to have a lot of the uncertainty removed, but you know, as I mentioned a couple of times on Bloomberg with you, Joe, during the trade war, I always kind of looked at it as it was a lot more bark than bite, and ultimately, you know, the trade deal, quote unquote, was you know, it didn't really change anything structurally, and actually, it cemented financial entanglements between the U.S. and China. President-elect Biden's approach may kind of depart from that. And so we could see some geopolitical hiccups along the way, especially because China's becoming a little bit more aggressive with respect to what it considers its clients. I'm sure that, you know, we're going to see alliance building start to emerge, or alliance rebuilding start to emerge. But, you know, the transition has the potential to be a little bit messy. And in fact, I think that, you know, the personnel decisions that the transition team is making is interesting because the undersecretary for the U.S. Treasury, one of them, he actually was the lead negotiator for TPP. I think it signals that President-elect Biden wants to take a relatively active stance with respect to China. So, you know, that's always kind of in the cards, and it's probably a little bit less top of mind than it was under the Trump administration. So that could be something that catches us by surprise.
Well, John and Naufal, so great to talk to both of you. Real treat. Tons to think about into 2021. Maybe we'll do like a mid-year update, like next June or July, and sort of take stock of how things are going. I think that'd be good.
Yeah, cool. Absolutely.
All right. Well, looking forward to it, and I appreciate both of you and all the work you've done this year and helping us understand this. Thanks for coming on Odd-Lot.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Look forward to next time. Take care, guys.
That was great. I really think it, just in terms of understanding this year, I mean, throughout following both of them on Twitter, following their writings, et cetera, I don't think there's any two people that I think have had a clearer sense of the moving parts of the macro picture than those two. So it's great to talk to them about what they see happening next year.
Yeah, it was a really nice framing of the big macro trends for 2021. I got to say, you mentioned this idea of coming back and doing a mid-year update. I really hope that January 2021 is relatively boring and that it's not a repeat of what happened in January 2020 and that we don't have to have them come back on in February or something because the world is falling apart. I really hope that's the case.
I know.
But
it's like, I want it to be, like I said, we said at the beginning, a little less interesting, but, you know, not boring. I don't want a boring year, but a little more boring.
Well, I think even if we get a vaccine and even if we get a global economic recovery, which might normally be considered boring for financial journalists, I think it's still going to end up being an interesting year, as John and Nauf were saying, because of the policy implications and this handoff or the interaction between fiscal inflation and vaccine inflation. Like, even if everything goes as they were describing, there's still a big question mark over how the Fed reacts to that combination.
You know, the point that John made, and both of them, about the pro-cyclicality, the feedback loops of the current Fed posture, I just think, like, cannot be sort of understated. This idea that, like, okay, the Fed has, let's say the Fed holds rates at zero, and so, you know, earlier in the year, we had unemployment at over 10%. So zero rates, unemployment over 10%, you know, we have this accommodative level. If the Fed is still holding rates at zero with no intention of hiking anytime soon, when the unemployment rate is below 7%, then that is implicitly more accommodative because the level of the economy has improved, but we haven't got any corresponding tightening. So implicitly, we've been having this ongoing easing ever since the economy started rebounding in late March and early April. And I think that really helps explain some of the extremity of these moves, that it's like, if you're sort of easing further implicitly as the economy recovers, we, you know, you could see how, you know, there's the feedback loop that's sort of like, I think I remember someone put it as like rocket fuel for the market.
Yeah, I think Knopf actually said that. No, that's exactly right. I think they mentioned that Brainard speech about going from stabilization to accommodation. Like, there's a policy shift that is taking place. And so when you look at it through that framework, then U.S. stocks at an all-time record, like, it doesn't seem as divorced from economic reality as it would be otherwise.
I do think, like, the big question mark, however, is still, like, in the post-crisis landscape, whenever we can declare we're post-crisis, which is probably at some point when a lot of people have had the vaccine and it's just not a big issue anymore and everything's totally reopened, do we just go back to the pre-crisis environment of people buying 10-year bonds and Microsoft and calling it a day, or is there new leadership? And, like, I'm kind of skeptical that anything meaningfully macro changes. And I'm thinking back to, like, our conversation with Paul McCulley. It's like, in theory, we want to see some new, like, fiscal-led permanent change to how we do macro management. And that could produce a shift. But in fact, like, we can't even, like, get a minor extension to the CARES Act. And if you look at Biden's nominees, you know, like, a lot of them are sort of, like, progressive new thinkers, but also a lot of, like, you know, pretty mainstream conventional ideas, which means, like, it's still really hard to see, like, where the big long-term macro shift comes from sort of, you know, and then how do you get a big market shift without a big macro policy shift? Hard to see much changing.
Yeah, I think that's fair. That's fair. I mean, people are so focused on how to get from the current situation, from right now to this sort of end point in 2021 when things go back to normal, that I think a lot of people, like, we're so focused on the journey that we're not necessarily considering the destination of what that end point actually looks like. And I think you have a strong argument that maybe it just looks like, you know, what the earlier years actually look like.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, going to be an interesting year and plenty to talk about, and we'll have them back either way. And that's that. Should we leave it there?
Not too interesting, hopefully, as you mentioned. All right, let's leave it there. This has been another episode of the Odd Lots podcast. I'm Tracy Alloway. You can follow me on Twitter at Tracy Alloway.
And I'm Joe Weisenthal. You can follow me on Twitter at The Stalwart. Follow our guests on Twitter, Nawful Sanala. He's locked, but maybe he'll let you follow him. At Nawful Sanala. Follow our other guest, John Turek. He's at JTurek18. Follow our producer, Laura Carlson. She's at Laura M. Carlson. Follow the Bloomberg head of podcast, Francesca Levy, at Francesca Today. And check out all of our podcasts at Bloomberg under the handle at podcast. Thanks for listening.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.